In fact, what he basically said was that it takes the magnetization. The magnetization at zero magnetic field has a form which is proportional to minus T to the beta. And then he said, well, you take this ratio of T to the power beta to the magnetic field to the power 1 over delta, and that you, this is a generally good expression for the magnetization in the neighborhood of the critical point. This could equally well be written as minus T to the beta times some other function of minus T to the beta times delta divided by H. You just change the argument here by raising it to the power delta. And now one can make the following conclusions from that. Let us assume for a moment that the Q tilde of infinity is a constant. Then you get magnetization being proportional to minus T to the beta, as we know empirically. Let us assume that this constant is not real, because T is positive, so it's sort of, it's what we have is Q tilde times a infinity times a complex number. And then the assumption is that this thing is zero, so you get zero magnetization if you set magnetic field to zero and have T positive. The other way around, what you might want to do is use this formula, and you might ask, what happens as T goes to zero? As T goes to zero, these things are as H goes to zero. As T goes to zero, in order to get some result which is not infinite or zero, what we say is that Q of small argument goes to 1 over that argument, or x much less than 1. And we turn this over, we notice the t is canceled, and you get magnetization is equal to h to the 1 over delta times some constant. So Whittam showed us tricks for measuring one small quantity against another small quantity and express those tricks as a set of behavior of the magnetization. I think that isn't too hard. The next step is to go for the free energy. Minus beta times the free energy, you can think of as the number of particles in a system times the free energy per particle. That free energy per particle also, like everything else, depends on H and T in the neighborhood.
Excuse me, Leo, could you please turn your microphone on?
Ah, thank you, I'm sorry. I put it on and then forgot to turn it on. So let's go back to the thing right. Thank you very much.
I don't think we have a tremendous need for it in this room. On the other hand, we do broadcast to the world. Okay, maybe we did have a need for it in the room. Is there anything that didn't come across because I was too soft? I've been rarely criticized for being too soft. Okay. Now, we know that the magnetization is the derivative of the free energy with respect to magnetic field at constant temp T minus TC, or constant temperature. Then the free energy is the integral dH prime of the magnetization as a function of H prime and temperature, say from H prime equals 0 to H. This thing has the same size as the magnetization times H. This is the order of magnitude of the thing. I can show it to you by going to this form and changing variables and talking about when things are of order unity and so forth. But it is easier to just say it, to say that the magnetization is of the form minus T to the beta, that H has a size which is typically minus T to the beta delta, and what is you're left over with is a function that I will call F star of this argument, H, nope, minus T to the beta delta over H. When I was visiting at a college in the United States, I gave a lecture in which I was talking about some moderately elementary physical phenomenon, and I used an argument somewhat like this. And the professor, a first-rate educator, told the students, well, Kadnoff does it this way. You have to do it differently. You have to be more careful. Okay, fine. You're now grown-up people. You don't have to do it differently. You don't have to be more careful. What you have to do is to be able to estimate the order of magnitude of things and get a result like that. You also ought to be able to take a formula like this and a formula like this, and from that derive something like that. Either way, this is what Whittam said, and is the essence of his ansatz, his assumption, his guess about the nature of this problem. And so from the expression for the magnitude of the magnetization, you get an expression for the free energy. And once you've got the free energy, you have everything in the world. He, in fact, wrote two papers about this subject at the time. One paper was about this, and the other paper was about how the free energy might be connected to the coherence length. That's not exactly what it was about, but I'm going to interpret it that way. The order of magnitude estimate goes the following way. We have a free energy has in it a kT, which we're just writing as 1 here because we're only interested in the dependence of things on these small quantities. The total free energy in the system, that is N times the free energy density, is kT times the number of degrees of freedom. And I guess I should put a wiggle there because we're talking about orders of magnitude. In fact, you imagine the system, I'm going to come back to that again and do it differently, but you imagine the system being separate, being built up of boxes, each box of the size of the coherence length, and each box only being sort of weakly correlated to the other boxes. So the number of degrees of freedom is the total volume of the system divided by the coherence length to the power d. D being the dimension of the system, and that being a counting of the number of boxes of size the coherence length. And so since we have the coherence length being proportional to t to the power minus nu, this is a definition of nu. Nu, I recall for you, is equal to 0.5 in mean field theory to 0.62 in three dimensions and to 1 in two dimensions for an Ising-like system. You then get that the free energy per unit volume is proportional to t to the dimension of the system times nu. And that is another guess of Wittem's, and that's a very important and good guess. Okay, I now claim to have explained in pretty decent detail and sort of at very high speed the contents of what Wittem did. Do you all want to ask questions?
You said that we have to approximate integrals like this. My natural guess would be that what you get is not minus t to beta delta, but minus t to minus beta delta.
Your natural guess is in fact, no. Okay. Your natural guess is not, I don't think, correct. Let me phrase it the way I would guess it. H has a magnitude which is estimable from here. Typical values of H are like t to the beta delta. So that when you do this integral, you cover a distance, roughly speaking, t to the beta delta. You then have multiplying by the value of the magnetization. So here's the distance you cover, here's the value of the magnetization. You're going to push, let me describe it. Okay. Sigma. No. F, free energy per unit volume, is the integral dh of the prime from 0 to h of the magnetization as a function of h prime and t. There is also a factor of the free energy at h equals 0, but I'm going to leave that out for there's an additive term to the free energy at h equals 0. I'm going to use yet a third form for this magnetization, which just makes it simpler for me. I'm going to say that the magnetization is equal to minus t to the beta times some function q double tilde of h over minus t to the beta. I can have q tilde. I can certainly have q double tilde, this function of the same argument turned over.
Do you remove the delta then?
I did remove the delta. That's a lie, a calumny. Thank you. There's the delta. So there all the time, as you know. Thank you. So
we then have an integral of dh prime from 0 to h of minus t to the beta times q tilde of h over t to the minus t to the beta delta, h prime. And now I will change variables on us. Capital H prime is equal to H prime over minus T to the beta delta. This is then an integral, the H prime from 0 to H over minus T to the beta delta of minus T to the beta. And as I change variables, I get an additional factor of minus T to the beta delta numerator. H prime has the same factor in the denominator. Numerator and denominator cancel out. And I'm finally left with a function Q double tilde of H capital H prime. I then say Q double tilde is of order 1. The integral of the h prime covers a distance more or less like that. And what I'm getting is minus t to the beta plus beta delta times some function of h over minus t to the beta delta. So real math supports this sort of hand-waving argument. The hand-waving argument gives you the right answer and is quicker, but is less convincing.
Let me see where I was. I'm going to start out by using the computer.
But Leo, your hand-waving argument works because it's essentially a dimensional analysis at this point.
It's dimensional analysis. Now, I'm not... dimensional analysis is usually done with meters and seconds and degrees centigrade and that kind of thing. This is a sort of dimensional analysis which is a little bit different. In fact, this sort of dimensional analysis is something that we had to teach people how to do. A bunch of us wrote a review paper in 1967 in which we saw the main goal of the review paper was to teach people how to do this, because the traditional dimensional analysis deals with the traditional variables, and these are non-traditional variables. So first thing I do is I say RGB. Second, I see what I can find on my computer, if I can find anything. It will be brighter if I plug it in. I'll be able to figure out better what I'm up to. Okay. And then we go. Life is hard. We go to lecture 7. And we look for the Dirac lecture. And we then wonder whether it's up on the thing. Because it should be up on the thing. No, not RGB, it's HDMI. That's why it's not up on the thing. Okay, back, I think that's good enough. Front 2, I do that. No, I do escape and then find the right place first of all. Okay, that's where we were. That's where we were. We were there. 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 Now, after all this effort of putting this up, I'm going to do it on the blackboard with dots. My basic unit in which I'm going to think about things is a unit in which I have a bunch of dots, each dot representing, as usual, a spin. I got a whole bunch of units. Each one of which has the appropriate number of dots in it, but I'm not going to fill them in. And then I define a new variable. These variables are sigma r. I define a new variable. Mu r being the center of this box, and one for each box. And I will say, first in thinking about it, that mu r is the SIGN sign of the magnetization in the box. That is the total spin in the box, the sum over r, sigma r in the box. Therefore, that is mu r is plus 1 if this is positive and minus 1 if that's negative. And that this then gives us a new representation of the old problem. That in this new representation, we are going to get a new description of the problem. Let me, in fact, give you a more formal way of doing that same thing. We want to calculate the partition function, which is the sum over, the sum over all the sigmas of e to the minus beta h that depends on the sigmas. And then we do this calculation by sticking in a factor, which I will call t, which relates all the mu's to all the sigmas. So this is all the guys. I will demand that the sum over mu of e to the t of mu and sigma equals 1. I'll put a sum over all the mu's here. And because of this demand, the partition function is equally well given by the formula in which this stuff is left out and the formula in which it's present. For example, T e to the t of mu and sigma might be the product over boxes of the delta of the exponential, of the sine function, the delta symbol that requires the sine of mu to be equal to the sine of the magnetization in the box. That's just what I said over on the other board. You can figure out how to make a T that does that. It's just a product over boxes of the requirement that the magnetization is equal to the mu has the same sign as the total magnetization in the box. This delta symbol, when summed over mu, is of course 1. Now comes the big deal statement. The big deal statement is that you can think of Z after the sum over sigma is done. You can imagine doing this sum over sigma. You have left the sum over mu, and you have something that depends on mu. We will call that e to the minus beta of h prime of mu. Let me put it up on another board where it isn't partially hidden, since it's the major thing that's being done here. Goodbye. Keep with us. E to the minus, a new Hamiltonian, which depends on all of the mu's, is the sum over all of the sigmas of this transformation factor, T, which depends on all of the mu's and all of the sigmas of and e to the minus beta h of sigma. The whole point is that you got the same physics, because all the physics there is in the partition function, but you have a different representation of that same physics now in terms of a system which is slightly different. We started out with a lattice constant, A. We now have a lattice constant, which is, according to the picture up there, or the picture up there, is three times as large. We started out with a number of spins equal to n. Now we have a new number of spins equal to n over L to the dimension of the system. We have, of course, minus beta times the free energy being exactly the same. However, we have the free energy per particle, because free energy is a number of particles times free energy per particle. The free energy per particle has changed. Multiply this by n. Nope, sign is wrong. This time I did it wrong. I didn't say the beta is the same, but okay, let me tell you, let me go through it step by step. Imagine that I was calculating the correlation function of two mu's, one at r and at zero, and then we're now calculating also the correlation of r and zero. These things are basically the same, except for factors, these two things. That is, if you go back to this board and this condition, mu r is, in essence, is exactly the sign of the total spin in the box. And it behaves very much like some constant times the spin in the box. This thing has an exponential behavior, e to the minus r divided by c. This thing has an exponential behavior, e to the minus capital R divided by c. But small r and capital R are the same distance. This is the c that's appropriate for the new system. So we conclude that C prime equals C. That's a somewhat harder calculation. The easier calculation that you're going to ask, that I'm going to do for you, is that the average magnetization in the new system is, with some constant of proportionality, the magnetization in the old system. And if this one goes as minus T to the beta, it must be true. It's going to be true that this one is going to also go as some critical temperature to the beta, some T prime. But I've jumped ahead of my story, so let me tell you the story as I would like to tell it to you. I lost it. Here it is. H depends on some set of couplings, K. That's how you describe the H. H prime has to be has to also depend on some set of couplings, K. We were thinking about the original problem, which I haven't put up there, in which there was a nearest neighbor coupling and probably nothing much else. Nearest neighbor coupling and a magnetic field, K and H. Okay. Now I enter the story as a personal actor. I ask my fairy godmother what I could wish for. My fairy godmother appears and tells me that if I do this right in the new problem, I will just have new couplings, K prime and H prime, and nothing else. Now, that isn't exactly true. My fairy godmother has produced a slightly better universe than the one that we really live in. But let us make the approximation or the assumption that as we go in this perfectly well-defined way from the old problem to the new problem, we get the same couplings out. This is not exactly true. We generate a next nearest neighbor coupling in addition to the nearest neighbor coupling. We generate a coupling among four spins and six spins and eight spins and all kinds of mess. But my fairy godmother has told me that isn't there. And I have said, well, I'm a hand-waving kind of physicist. I'm going to neglect this stuff. We have the same physics in the new problem as the old problem. That's physics is determined by the field, magnetic field, and by the deviation of the coupling from the critical temperature. So I write K as critical coupling minus T, K prime as critical coupling minus T prime. So the new problem is now defined in terms of H prime and T prime. If I could do the calculation involving the sums over sigma and all of that stuff, and if what my fairy godmother had promised me would be absolutely true, I would be able to calculate H prime and T prime as a function of H and T. However, I know something. The behavior of the new problem is very much like the behavior of the old problem, except, well, qualitatively similar. If we're close to the critical point in the old problem, we're going to be close to the critical point in the new problem. I therefore make the assumption that H prime is some constant times H, and T prime is some constant times T, in order to use the same symbol, not to use the same symbol twice. I call this one BH and that one B. Alice was asked to believe two impossible things before breakfast. Well, it's after breakfast, and you can certainly do three impossible things at this point. Okay, we're there now. We can, in fact, get all the phenomenology that Widom put together. Let me see whether I want to do it on this. No, I'm going to do it on the blackboard. I'll get myself a blackboard. We turn off that way. And in 10 seconds, this comes up, and I get a little more blackboard. 1, 8, 9, 10. Good. Glad to hear this. So now we can start to talk about the behavior of the system, and I wanted to define some of the phenomenology that we see in the behavior of the system. The partition function for the two cases is the same. So n times the function of h and t is n prime times the same old function of h prime and t prime. I'm going to get Widom out of this. I'm going to get Widom's phenomenology from this point of view. Notice that we have used, in getting this far, some idea of scaling. That as you change the length scale in the problem, you're not going to change the problem in any essential way. You just have to change the variables that you use to describe the problem. N prime is n. This is fewer degrees of freedom. It's n over L to the d. H prime is h times this coefficient b sub h. And t prime is assumed to be t times b. And of course, b sub h and b depend on the scale change that you've done. It is good to guess that b sub h and b are proportional to factors of the scale change. And scale change raised to some power. Now I'd like to get L out of the problem. The physics is that the problem has a structure which is independent of scale, that is independent of the size of L. And a little bit of arithmetic will tell you that if f of h and t is of the form t to some power times some function, sort of like the q's we played with, of t divided by h to some other power, that this will, in fact, guarantee that all the L's will fall out of this equation. I have to show you that. First, let's talk about this factor. T over h to the q goes into prime over h prime to the q when we go through this. This is a different function, so I better put another symbol on it to make sure that it's different. And t prime is t times b, and h prime is h times b sub h, and this is all raised to the power q. And this is then t over h to the q divided by L times L to the y divided by L to the q times y sub h. Aha! I can now make sure that this thing and this thing are the same by simply insisting that y equals q times y sub h. I will not carry this further. I will just wave my hands around and say that the assumptions made here produce precisely the same phenomenology as Whittam and have the further advantage that they give some hint of where that phenomenology comes from. The phenomenology is a result of scaling. That is, that the problem should be described at different length scales by different size boxes, and of universality. That is the statement that it doesn't matter what scale you look at, basically the problem has fundamentally, down deep, the very same description. In fact, if this is, so far, you have what I said in 1966 to somewhat advance the art of phase transitions. Now let me carry it just a little further using this universality concept. This is not something I brought in 1966, but indeed it is something that we should be able to say. In the real world, this kind of transformation generates a whole bunch of other couplings. My fairy godmother told me something nice, but it's not true. However, universality suggests, that is, the idea that different phase transition problems have in the critical region exactly and precisely the same solution, precisely the same solution. Universality suggests that I can, even though we have these new couplings generated, I have basically the same problem over again, and I can do the same kind of analysis over again. I did not realize exactly how that all fit together at the time. Physics is a subject in which one makes progress step by step. Not exactly. That is, there are three important scales in the problem. Size of the system, the coherence length, and the lattice constant. I would like to be working in the region in which, wrong way around, thank you. A gasp from my friends helps out. this coherence length is proportional to t minus tc to the power minus nu. So this gets arbitrarily large as we get close to the critical point. But we can, since L is a meter and A is an angstrom for a typical phase transition system, we have plenty of room to have these inequalities satisfied. The statement is that over the whole range in which this is true, and some which this is true, we have basically the same description. And that scale invariance is not quite a scale invariance, it is rather a scale covariance, in which you have H and T and distance, and you measure these quantities against one another with the appropriate powers. So it isn't exactly an invariance, but it's a covariance. Okay. My apologies. There's a very clear on the slide gray arrow representing the new variable mu. This is very light here. But you can see what's going on. There's a new variable describing this whole block. There's a change in the lattice constant, and the fewer degrees of freedom produces some sort of renormalization. I told you a lot about that already, and I'm going to go on. Now, this is okay as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. There is a lot of hand-waving and phenomenology in here, and two unknown constants. Two unknown constants, which maybe I should call, maybe not point to the B's, but the Y's, that is the powers. The B's are powers of the length change, and those powers are unknown. So this looked good. You hear something about how new theories get a hard time getting accepted. This didn't have the slightest bit of a hard time. Everybody loved it. Everybody said it was sort of nice and great, but nobody knew what to do with it. So for 5 years between 1966 and 1971, nothing much happened. Kenneth G. Wilson, a colleague of mine at Harvard, who then went off to Cornell, is the kind of person who works on a problem in a very, very, very focused fashion. He also has an ability to emulate a computer in his mind. What Ken did was advance the thinking about the problem by saying, let's not think about the simple two couplings. Let us imagine we have all of the couplings in the problem that possibly could agree with the symmetry, translational symmetry, and the symmetry between spin up and spin down. So we've considered all possible couplings. And then he said, something equivalent to, I don't need a fairy godmother. I start with all couplings here. I end up at the next step with all couplings. He then followed Gell-Mann and Lowe, who suggested not that you do one renormalization, but you do several, in many, many renormalizations in a row. We talked about that, actually, when we did the one-dimensional problem. We did many renormalizations until we reached a fixed point. This fixed point concept was brought into the story by Wilson and then made a big difference. I think that is on the next slide for where the big difference came from. The whole story could be described in terms of three different kinds of fixed points. So you continue the change in length scale until you reach the limits of the system. You do a finite system. That's one possible thing. or you imagine an infinite system. At this point, I should jump up and down and point out that the extended singularity theorem demanded that we think about an infinite system. There it is, right there. So we've something good has happened. That we think about an infinite system, and then after many, many renormalizations, what will happen is the couplings may settle down, they usually do, to an unchanging thing. So we do 10 or 100 renormalizations, and the couplings settle down and are unchanged after this large number of renormalizations. We have then reached what is called a fixed point. There are then three kinds of fixed points. If you start out with couplings stronger than the value that you need to reach criticality, you reach a strong coupling fixed point. This has the property that the variables are strongly aligned, as they would be if you looked on a large scale. And this is a description of I prefer to say here, not a liquid phase, but this is a description of a strongly correlated magnetic phase in which you have a magnetization. You started out with sort of weak couplings, they would get weaker and weaker and weaker, and you'd end up in a weak coupling phase in which, like the paramagnetic phase that I talked about, or like a vapor phase in which particles don't interact much with each other. Those are two possibilities. You can either go there or you can go there, but if you're sort of halfway in between, or rather if you're at a special value of the coupling equal to the critical coupling, you stay where you were. So the phase diagram looks like, roughly speaking, let me find an eraser. No, I don't need it. Yeah, I need an eraser. So the phase diagram, roughly speaking, looks like, I imagine the phase diagram projected on one coupling, since it's hard to imagine a very large number of couplings. There is a critical value of the coupling. As we do renormalizations, if we start out with weak couplings, we move towards a weak coupling fixed point at zero. If we start out with strong couplings, we move step by step to a strong coupling fixed point, usually described as being at k equals infinity. And if you're in between, you stay here at this critical fixed point. Now you do have scale invariance. Nothing changes when you change the size of the system. If you started out a little bit over to this side, you wouldn't have scale invariance because you'd go this way, or a little on this side, you'd go that way. And this then becomes a description of the problem in an elegant way, which makes use of the infinite system and has very lovely features to it. Okay, this is the big deal place, and so if maybe you want to ask a question or comment here. Yep.
Can we ever have stable fixed points at non-zero or non-infinite value of the couplings?
Okay. Let me think about it in physical terms. A fixed point is a description of the physics of what goes on, which does not change as you change the size of your ruler. You change your length scale. A stable fixed point is one in which all of the behavior in the neighborhood of that flows into that behavior. All of the behavior in the neighborhood of this flows into that behavior. So we need something which is non-trivial, but which will remain unchanging
as we change the length scale and will remain unchanging as we change the structure of the problem slightly. Yes, the answer is that such things exist. They're called topological phases of matter. For example, if you have a XY model, that is a model in which the magnetization can point in various directions in two-dimensional space, you can get situations in which there are swirling patterns stuck in the system. Swirling patterns looking like that, or swirling patterns looking like this. These frozen in swirly patterns tend to be relatively stable. They tend to be described by fixed points, and they tend to be scale invariant. So part of, I guess my answer is yes, but I had to think about it. Okay, let me then talk about why this is an important result. That's technical, I don't want that. I've got to do it, okay. In fact, you've heard a little bit about this story, and it's not entirely new to you. In your field theory lectures, you heard the word relevant, irrelevant, and marginal words. Let me tell you about those words because they're crucial to the story. So Franz Wegener, who was a postdoc at Brown while I was there, said that you could make lumped variables for the problem, some combination of nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor, and other couplings, which would then be the variables which would actually scale the way I said variables would scale. And so you have variables which have couplings, which I will call K sub mu, which have a simple scaling properties. K mu prime is L to the power Y sub mu times K mu. Then you can classify that on this slide, no, it's on the next slide. This slide defines K mu, saying that there are important combinations of variables which define a collection of couplings, in fact, an infinite collection of them, with different values of y. The T minus TC is one kind of coupling, it has a y, magnetic field is another kind of coupling, and so forth. Those y's can be classified into different groups. There is y bigger than 0, and y less than 0, and y equals 0. In fact, there's a possibility of oscillatory behavior, which means complex y, but that usually isn't realized, and I'm not going to talk about it. If y is bigger than 0, this kind of variable will grow. That's like the deviation from the critical point, which grows as the length scale grows, and we move away from the critical point. So examples of this are T minus TC and magnetic field, which become more and more important as you go far away from the critical point. Other variables have Y less than 0, and they are termed irrelevant. They are irrelevant. Somebody will help me. Is it E or an A?
A.
Thank you. I'm getting better as time goes on. I get them right more often. These are termed irrelevant. That is, as you do renormalizations, they vary, and because y is less than zero, they get smaller and smaller and less important as you look on a large scale. In fact, the Isaac model phase transition, the liquid gas phase transition, or the magnetic phase transition, for guys that can point in only a few directions, there are precisely two relevant variables, one corresponding to T minus TC, and other the symmetry breaking H. Everything else is irrelevant. And you have just learned something by this classification. Let's leave y equals zero out of our mind for a moment. We might have five relevant variables, and all of the irrelevant ones can be forgotten about because they we might have five relevant variables, five different values of mu, which we have variables like this, but everything else can be forgotten about. When I, or Winham, made the guess that the Ising problem could be described in terms of two variables, we were precisely right. Now, that was not a guess. We were following up on what other people had done for decades. And so that turned out to be correct. However, if this classification, leaving out that possibility, is accepted, you can then recognize that there are only a few different classes of problems. They are problems, there are only a few different fixed points, few meaning a denumerably infinite number of fixed points. If you have a space, like space, which has many dimensions in it, the problems in that many-dimensional space will flow into a few fixed points. Maybe one there, maybe another one there, maybe another one there. They have different numbers of relevant variables, hence different stability properties. But all kinds of phases, all the phases of matter, can be described in terms of a few different fixed points, each of them being discrete and enumerably defined. That's what happens if there is no marginal variable. If there is a marginal variable, a y equals zero variable, then it is possible, not required, but possible, that you can have a continuously varying situation in which there's some variable which describes a continuously changing fixed point, so that on that picture where I showed a few fixed points, there would be a lines perhaps of continuously varying fixed points. However, this is a rare behavior, relatively rare. And mostly what one sees is this relevant and irrelevant kind of thing. And now we have something absolutely wonderful that has happened. Let's see if it says it here. Okay, this is a classification, but in terms of y, has the right spelling of relevant and all of that kind of stuff. I just said this, but let me say it again. Start from some microscopic system. We want to understand macroscopic behavior near the critical point. You adjust the relevant coupling so the system is near the critical point. You do the renormalization, lots of them, and you approach the macroscopic behavior. You notice the irrelevant couplings have renormalized almost to zero since the system approaches one of a few distinct fixed points. So very many different starting points reduce to a few distinct fixed points. These distinct fixed points each define what is called a universality class. That is a problem, a set of problems, which are all the same if one looks at them at a large length scale. Each member of the universality class has identical behavior at a large length scale, identical behavior in its critical region. This is an important change.
in the classical view of physics, we solve problems one at a time. We are given a harmonic oscillator or a pendulum or something or other, and we take that problem, solve it, and describe what goes on. This point of view, in which universality gives us things to say, says that if we want to look at a certain class of properties, like what happens at large length scales, we define universality classes, and then we solve whole piles of problems all together. In fact, you accepted this when you accepted my talking about the Ising model and saying it was an Ising model, but it was also a liquid gas phase transition and was also a magnetic phase transition. It is all of those things. And so instead of talking about individual problems, we talk about universality classes and classes of different problems. This just says that this is what's in the Ising model universality class. The XY model, which is one that has magnetization that can point in any one of a direction in a plane, is a magnetization, was a magnet with a easy plane of magnetization. The same universality class describes the superfluid, because the superfluid has a phase of its wave function which behaves just like this angle. And also, and I can't describe this in detail, in two dimensions, this describes a solid to fluid phase transition. Okay, I've said this, that you could, that you group theories together. But that now I want to say sort of what the renormalization group is really about. You start with an ensemble. You calculate a new ensemble after many renormalizations. You find a fixed point. You are now talking about classes of theories, but that's not what I want to talk about on this slide. The fixed points are not necessarily themselves trivial things. For example, if you started with strong interactions in a solid, a fixed point could be a solid phase, a phase in which you had a crystal lattice. And then you have a theory of crystal lattices, which is non-trivial. That theory is elasticity and has all kinds of interesting behaviors. So that you start out with a theory on a microscopic scale, you do renormalizations, and you end up with some theory on a macroscopic scale. That is, the strong coupling fixed points are all interesting fixed points in that they are interesting theories that come out, like elasticity or acoustics or ferromagnetism or superconductivity. The renormalization group is really a device for connecting theories on different length scales. Renormalization group is equally applicable to condensed matter and to particle physics concerns. I just talked about the condensed matter application. You start out with atomic forces, and you end up with elasticity theory. In particle physics, you start out with, say, stuff on the Planck scale, and pretty soon you're calculating properties that might be relevant for the Large Hadron Collider, or maybe for the nuclear physics. Again, the renormalization group provides you with a way of understanding the relationship between physics on one length scale and another. And that's what it's really all about. It's really all about going from one length scale to another. Already more or less said this. Each universe, no, not exactly. Each universality class shows a connection between a microscopic internal symmetry and the topological properties of a large hunk of space, much larger than the range of forces. It shows up thermodynamic singularities and correlation functions and all that stuff. The connection that you're seeing here between the microscopic and the macroscopic is one of the most interesting and deepest things in physics. And in fact, we're talking about the topological properties of space in a very small scale interaction, and then the topological properties again of space and of its large scale behavior. That's deep stuff. It's deep stuff in condensed matter physics, and it's deep stuff in particle physics as well. Dirac, who, as you may recall, was the subject of this lecture, Dirac said that he would agree with renormalization, with doing renormalization stuff, if it wasn't so ugly. What Dirac meant, I think, Dirac never said anything in such an extended way that you could figure out exactly 110% what he meant. But what he meant, I think, was that the infinities that you see in field theory, infinities that start out, for example, in the infinite self-mass of a point particle, that those infinities are ugly and show that all of the field theories can't be carried to infinitesimal distances, and hence that the various field theories cannot be a fundamental theory of nature, because at some distance they break down. That is what I think he meant by the statement that renormalization is ugly. He particularly wanted, I believe, a theory that would be applicable down to the very smallest scales. No, not to the smallest scales, down to zero scale, and would describe in a final and complete way the whole universe of scales. He got as close as you can get to that with the Dirac equation, but we haven't gotten there yet, and we are, well, okay. Now, I started this talk with talking about the difference between particle physicists and condensed matter physicists. Condensed matter physicists believe that the world is a zillion different problems, each problem being fascinating in itself, and you can learn from one problem and apply it to another. It is people who work in particle physics, string theory, cosmology, have a somewhat different point of view. They believe that there is a fundamental theory of the universe, and that we are getting closer to it, and that we will see it when we get to the right scale. Dirac then said that renormalization is ugly because it shows us that there are infinities at small scales and that you don't have things that you could take to a zero scale. I think about the world in a way in which every time you look at a different scale, you see different physics. You see wonderful physics in the flow of hydrodynamic flow of the air in this room. You see wonderful physics in the ideas of string theory. I see great physics in the ideas of cosmology. I believe that the renormalization group provides you with a technique for connecting physics that one sees at one scale with the physics that you see at another scale. Therefore, I will argue against Dirac and say that the renormalization group is not ugly, but quite beautiful indeed. Thank you all for listening.